Our passage for today comes from Mark 8, 27 through 9:1. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others will say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." And he said to them, "Truly I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see that the kingdom of God has come with power." Well, good morning. As we've been making our way through the Gospel of Mark, through these first 8 chapters, the big question has been, who is Jesus? Who is this that teaches with authority and casts out demons and can control the wind and waves and heal the sick? And for Peter, as we looked at last week, on the road up to Caesarea Philippi, he has this flash of insight, and in this stunning confession answers that question. You are the Messiah. You're the Christ. You're not just a teacher. You're not just a prophet. You are the Messiah, this anointed royal figure in the line of David who was believed to be to come and defeat Israel's enemies and establish God's kingdom. So now that this question has been answered, who is Jesus? We've come to this, as I said, this continental divide in Mark's gospel. The major question in our story now becomes, what does it mean for Jesus to be the Messiah? And that's where we're turning today. We're in Mark chapter 8, verse 31, if you want to follow along. And notice a few things here in the first part. First, Jesus switches up the titles. So Peter confesses that Jesus is the Messiah, and then Jesus seemingly accepts that title. But when he begins to talk about himself, he refers to himself as the Son of Man. So the Son of Man would have been a pretty ambiguous title at this time. It wouldn't have had the political and military connotations that the title Messiah had. But this actually becomes the Jesus' preferred way of referring to himself, particularly when he refers to his suffering. So again, to answer our question, what kind of Messiah is Jesus going to be? Well, he's going to be a suffering Messiah. He's going to suffer, be rejected, be killed, and not at the hands of like a godless and wicked people, but actually at the hands of respected religious leaders, so elders and chief priests and scribes. As Jesus begins to lay this out, notice that he does it plainly. In other words, when Jesus begins to speak about this, about being the suffering Messiah, he doesn't do it in a parable form. He doesn't speak cryptically about suffering and being rejected and being killed. No, he says it in as clear of a manner as he can. He said, "I'm not the kind of Messiah you're expecting." And Peter is shocked at this. Everything in Peter recoils at this picture that Jesus has just painted. There's then these two visions of the Messiah that have now flashed in front of Peter. And one has been this triumphant Messiah, the vision in Peter's head. And then there's this vision that Jesus presents, which is a suffering Messiah. And the second vision is not only blurry and distorted, it's really incomprehensible to Peter. And in Peter's defense, nothing in his background could have prepared him for this. So there have been various understandings in first century Judaism about exactly what the Messiah would be, and there's some differences in that. But as far as we can tell, none of those understandings included a suffering Messiah. So this would have been a suffering Messiah is essentially an oxymoron in their minds. It's an impossibility. It's a red six of spades. And the pathways that in Peter's head, he just can't make sense of this. And so Peter takes Jesus aside and begins to rebuke him. And this word rebuke is really strong. Up until this point in our story, the ones who have been rebuked are the demons. But now it's Peter who's taken aside his rabbi to rebuke him. So for any disciple to rebuke his rabbi, this would have been a serious breach of protocol. But Peter isn't just rebuking his rabbi. He's rebuking the one he just confessed to be the Messiah, the anointed one. So let's think about, why is Peter doing this? I mean, Peter is, as we scandalized by this vision of a suffering Messiah. But I think there's more going on than just that. Peter has vested interest in Jesus being a certain type of Messiah, doesn't he? I mean, Peter's part of this campaign. He is all in following Jesus. And in Peter's mind, where is this path headed? Well, it's headed to a throne where a Messiah belongs. Meaning in Peter's mind, if Jesus is headed to a throne, he is, in a sense, headed to a seat at Jesus' cabinet. And we know this must have been on their minds to some degree, because a couple chapters later, Mark, James and John, so the other two members in Jesus' inner circle, along with Peter, say to Jesus, "We want you to do whatever we ask." And Jesus answers, "Well, okay, what do you want me to do for you?" And they say, "We want you to sit at your right hand and your left hand." He left. And so basically they say, we want to be Secretary of State and the other one be Secretary of Defense. And knowing Peter, he's probably thinking he's in line for vice president. So we just finished a political campaign season. Imagine how this would work. I mean, I'm probably, for better or for worse, pretty soon we're going to start hearing about people gearing up for the 2024 election. So people, rising stars in the parties, the party will start laying the groundwork for a campaign and start inviting people close to them to join that campaign. They might say something like, "I can't promise it's going to be easy. You're going to spend countless nights on the road and in motels and away from your family. And you're going to travel through Iowa in winter. And you're going to eat lots of unhealthy fair food in the summer. You're going to sacrifice 2 years of your life. And at the end of this long, hard campaign, I will be soundly defeated. I'm going to be totally crushed." So who's going to join this campaign? People typically join a campaign because they have vested interest and they believe that this campaign has a shot at winning. So I want you to see that Peter has his fortunes tied with Jesus' fortunes. And all of a sudden, those fortunes don't look so great. So verse 33, "But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. 'Get behind me, Satan,' he said. 'You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns.'" So just moments ago, Peter has made this stunning confession, and now moments later, he's receiving this stunning rebuke from Jesus. Really, this is a really remarkable scene. I want you to try to see this scene in your head. So Peter's taken Jesus aside to rebuke him. Maybe he doesn't want to do it in front of the other disciples. But now Jesus turns and looks at his disciples. So we have Jesus looking at his disciples with at his back, presumably Peter. And he says, "Get behind me, Satan." So Jesus not only speaks his rebuke, but he physically acts it out by putting Peter behind him. Disciples are expected to follow behind their teacher. And Jesus is communicating with both his body, his physical body, and his words, "Peter, you are not leading this campaign. You are not the one out front. I didn't pick you to be the drum major in this parade. Get back in line." It's really a stunning rebuke. And think about it. Many people think that Peter was possibly a key source for the material in Mark's gospel. So imagine 30 years later, Peter and John Mark are sitting around and Peter starts to tell this story. He's like, "It happened so fast. I had this incredible moment of insight. I was on top of the world." And he started talking about suffering and dying, and then I started to rebuke him, and then he started to rebuke me, and then I got called Satan. So imagine how hard that last line would have been to spit out. Like, we've probably all been called some less than flattering things in our lives, probably not that, you know, what is, you know, think about it. What does Jesus even mean when he says that? What does it mean to be, for Jesus' arch enemy, Satan, to somehow surface in his most prominent disciple, Peter? Well, think back after Jesus' baptism, way back in chapter 1, Jesus, we read, is immediately driven into the wilderness where he is tempted by Satan. And we don't get the specific temptations in Mark's gospel, but we do get them in Matthew's. And the last temptation in Matthew's gospel by Satan to Jesus is Satan offers him all the kingdoms of the world. And he says, it's all yours. All you have to do is bow down and worship me. So what is Satan doing with this last temptation? He seems to be tempting Jesus to take a different path to glory and authority, an easier path. You know, bow down to me, and it's all yours. You don't have to take the way of the cross. And Jesus responds by saying, away from me. So now Jesus hears this again, but he hears this temptation through now his own disciple saying, there's another way. There's another way. There's another way to glory. There's a way that doesn't lead through suffering and death. And Jesus again has to reject that temptation. And he does it in almost the exact same language as he did the first time. Get behind me, Satan. So Satan takes many different guises. Often we think about Satan at work as trying to tempt us to do things we know we shouldn't do, take us to places we know we shouldn't be, or watch things we shouldn't watch. But there's a sobering thing about this rebuke. When disciples of Jesus try to get out in front of Jesus, and they try to lead rather than follow behind, when they try to distort the way of Jesus, try to water it down and take away the hard parts and take away the parts that maybe make us uncomfortable, that's not of God. And it must be rebuked by Jesus in no uncertain terms. But notice Jesus isn't rejecting Peter. And there's a difference between rebuking and rejecting. Jesus has big plans for Peter. But Peter has some serious, serious unlearning to do. I mentioned last week that unlearning something is hard. In many ways, unlearning something is way harder than learning something. And Peter, since he was just a little boy on his parents' lap, has learned about a triumphant Messiah that is to come. So not a suffering Messiah. And that is not going to be easy to unlearn. And we read in the passage that Jesus began to teach them. So we get the sense that this is the beginning of Jesus trying to communicate, trying to teach them, trying to explain what exactly kind of the kind of Messiah he is, because it just does not compute in their heads. So it's interesting. In this confession, Peter is simultaneously right and wrong. He has the right title for Jesus, the Messiah, but he has the wrong view of what it means for Jesus to be the Messiah. And this is important for numerous reasons, but one, as we're going to see right here, if you have the wrong view of messiahship, you're going to lead you to the wrong view of discipleship, of following after Jesus. So right after Jesus redefines what it means to be the Messiah, he immediately turns to explaining what it means for those who will then follow him. Verse 34, then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples. So this whole time, as this has been happening, it's kind of felt like Jesus has been out on this road or around Caesarea Philippi alone with his disciples. And then all of a sudden, bam, there's this crowd that Jesus calls alongside. And I think the importance of this is that Mark has shown us this is not just directed to the 12. Like there's not two different standards of discipleship. There's not a high bar for the 12, and then there's a lower bar for everyone else. No, listen to what Jesus says here. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. So this is an open invitation. This isn't just for the 12. It isn't even just for the crowd. It's for anyone. It's an invitation. And I think it's important to point out, Jesus, as we watch him, never forces anyone to follow him. He never extends the invitation to follow him, and then the person walks away and he commands them to follow him. He also doesn't renegotiate the terms. So a couple months back, I was at a car dealership looking to trade in my car, and the dealership does as they often do. They make an offer and presumably the best offer for your car, and it seemed a bit low to me. So I left, and not long after that, I got a call on my phone from them saying they could offer something better. So car dealerships do that. Jesus doesn't do that. He doesn't lay out the offer. And then someone walks away and he says, well, wait, let's renegotiate some more favorable terms. It's important because no one can say, especially if you read this passage, that Jesus coerces people to follow him by false pretenses. Jesus isn't a huckster. Jesus lays this out plainly, in stark terms, what it means to follow him. That means to follow me is to deny yourself, to take up your cross and follow me. But what is this? Let's think about this. What does this mean to deny yourself? Well, let's start out with a few things about what this doesn't mean. Jesus is not saying deny things to yourself. So at Lent, many of us often give up something we enjoy, sugar or coffee or whatever. And denying yourself may mean denying things, but that's not what Jesus is getting at here. I don't think. He's not saying deny your happiness or deny any kind of form of delight in your life. He's not even saying you just need to be, you know, more self-disciplined. Denying yourself also doesn't mean denying your self-worth or denying your brains or denying your individuality. Denying oneself is not denying something to oneself, but it's denying the self itself. We don't often think about it this way, but we are constantly tempted to make ourselves little gods, to make the world revolve around us and our wants and our needs. And when we deny ourselves, we say, I don't bow down to that God anymore. I don't bow down to that God of self. And we do that as followers of Jesus. We say no to ourselves as little gods, to our own lordship, so that we can say yes to Jesus and his lordship. I don't know what exactly stops you from giving your life fully over to God. I have a much better sense of what stops me, but it's going to be different for each of us. You know, for those that are proud and really hungering for the approval from others, it's going to mean renouncing that desire for status and honor and fame. You know, for the greedy, it's going to be renouncing that appetite for wealth. For the complacent, it could be renouncing the love of ease. For the faint-hearted, it could be renouncing the need for that security, to abandon that craving for security. Like, you're going to likely be the one that knows what is the biggest barrier to you, what you are going to have to say no to. I'm not going to follow that path because I have a new Lord, and he leads me on this way, and it's he that blazes the path, not me. Secondly, take up your cross. This is a challenging one, primarily, I think, for a couple reasons. One of them is that crosses to us are primarily jewelry or decorations. The cross is a sign of beauty to us. It's a symbol of God's love. We wear it. We put it in our house. We sing beloved songs about its ruggedness. But for the people who first heard this, the cross was an image of extreme repugnance. It was an instrument of cruelty, of pain, dehumanization, and shame. There was nothing in their minds that was beautiful about the cross, like there is in our minds. And this is not something you wanted to take up under any circumstance. And when we tend to talk about taking up our crosses, often we also make it into kind of a figure of speech. So taking up your cross can refer to, you know, maybe an illness or a disability or some challenge, or, you know, some, it could even be a difficult person in your life, and we'll say something like, well, that's my cross to bear. That's probably more like a thorn in your flesh. It's not, I don't think it's exactly a cross to bear. The picture, at least in these original first century minds, that probably would have come up in their minds was of a criminal. So a criminal is forced to carry a cross beam on which they're about to be executed. Daryl Johnson puts it this way. A criminal picked up his cross only after receiving the death sentence. When a criminal carried his cross through the streets, for all practical purposes, he was a dead man. His life had ended. A man on his way to public crucifixion was compelled to abandon all earthly hopes and ambitions. Jesus calls his followers to think of ourselves as already dead, to bury the plans and agendas we made for ourselves. He will either resurrect our dreams or replace them with dreams and plans of his own. When you say yes to taking up the cross, you're saying, I'm a dead man. My life is, as I know it, is over. My dreams, my agenda, my plans, my ambitions, I'm going to bury those. I'm on my way to death. And some of those are going to be resurrected, and some of those are not. And so sometimes we hear this and we think of martyrdom. I think Jesus absolutely understood that disciples should be prepared to die if that is required. But I think in many ways, if we go there, if we just jump there, I think it's a way of kind of squirming our way out of what Jesus is actually saying. Because Jesus is not asking you to be open to the possibility of dying for your faith one day. He's not saying, you know, one day you may have to take up your cross. He's saying, no, take up your cross now. Die to yourself now. And I think this is way harder than thinking about a hypothetical martyrdom down the road. Because we want both, right? I think most of us want to follow Jesus, and we want to follow the path we're blazing. And Jesus lays out in very stark terms that this is not a possibility. This is not a both and proposal. Discipleship is not an add-on to your life. It's an either or choice. The claim Jesus makes on you and me as disciples is total and exclusive. I think it's easy to come to a hard passage like this and think, I got to try harder. When this is over, I'm going to try harder. I'm going to clean up my life. I'm going to drop some of the bad habits. I'm going to become a little bit less selfish and a little bit more loving. And I'm going to pull myself up by my moral bootstraps. And there may be true. We may need to make some changes, but I think if you just think of that, you're going to miss what's at the heart of Jesus' invitation. As the German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer said famously, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. This is an invitation to death. And can we just recognize that this is a hard word to hear? Discipleship is difficult. Following Jesus is costly. There are rigorous demands to it. I think it's easy for us to confuse the free gifts of grace and salvation from God with the costly demands of following Jesus. So it's absolutely true. Salvation costs us nothing. We can do nothing to earn the gift of salvation. And yet, and this is the paradox, it costs us everything. It costs us even our own lives. And I think in our society, in our culture, we've tended to focus pretty heavily on the first part, the grace and salvation part. And I think we've often tended to shy away or avoid or try to soften the second part, that following Jesus is costly. Neil Postman, who was an author and cultural critic, he wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. It was an expose on the influence of television in our culture. And he said this, "I believe I am not mistaken in saying that Christianity is a demanding and serious religion. When it is delivered as easy and amusing, it is another kind of religion altogether." So Postman was, as far as I can tell, I don't think he was not a Christian. And yet he seemed to recognize better than many of us do that when you present Christianity as something easy and amusing, you're not presenting Christianity, but something different altogether. You know, rather than deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me, I think we've adopted something that sounds more like say yes to yourself, take up your remote control, and follow your dreams. Say yes to yourself, take up your remote control, and follow your dreams. And I get that to some degree. I was studying this passage last night with my kids, and the older two in particular seemed to grasp that this was a hard passage. And as a parent, I felt these two conflicting desires. One, I wanted my kids to hear these stark words from Jesus, to know what discipleship entails. And at the same time, I they're wrestling with this. I wanted to swoop in and kind of temper this and kind of soften this, these words from Jesus. And we need to have a full exploration of the teachings of Jesus. But I get that. I get the desire to want to soften this. Which begs the question, I think as you think about this, who would say yes to this invitation? If Jesus never forces anyone to follow him, if he only extends an invitation, who in their right mind is going to say yes to such a costly invitation? Like, what is the good news here? And let me offer a few things. First, think back on your life. So as you think back on your life, things that you've pursued of significance or meaning, what has not been costly? So, for example, following Jesus, as we've seen, is costly, but so is raising kids. You know, if you sat down at the end of the day as a parent and you did some kind of cost benefit analysis of that day in terms of what you put into the kids and what you got out and changing diapers and feeding and schoolwork and putting them to bed and, you know, not to mention the actual economic cost to feed and clothe them and care for them, raising kids is a pretty costly endeavor, isn't it? Marriage is a form of self-denial. When you say yes to one person, when you pledge yourself in marriage to one person, it means you're saying no to that relationship to everybody else. It's a form of self-denial. When you become married, all kinds of doors are closed and freedom is lost. That's just the reality. Marriage is costly. Those of you who have started your own business, you know this is a costly endeavor in terms of the energy and the time and the finances that take to make that business succeed. Mastering your trade is costly. How many hours did you learn and did you spend learning and practicing what you do? Producing good art and writing is costly. My point is, as we reflect on our lives, I think we tend to recognize that so much of what makes our life rich and meaningful and purpose is exactly the things that are most costly. I think many of us would agree with that, but when we hear the idea that discipleship should be costly, we kind of balk at it. I just want to say, I'm really glad that Jesus didn't say, you know, we could go to Jerusalem or I could take you to the Mediterranean Sea. And there's this great beach and it has an all-inclusive resort and the buffets at night are incredible. You know, this might sound like kind of nice on the surface. I'd personally rather go to the mountains, but do you really want to give your life to that? Jesus doesn't call us to the life of ease. It's a costly call, but it's a call to a life of purpose and meaning and richness. Second, we got to keep reading here. We can't stop at the demands of Jesus, because in verse 35, he says this, whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? So I want you to notice something about this statement. Jesus is making a statement about reality. Jesus is very upfront about the realities of following him, both in terms of the cost and the rewards. Jesus extends the invitation saying, I hope in spite of the cost, you will choose to follow me because this is the path that leads to true life. This is how you're actually going to save your life. This is how you're actually going to meet your deepest hungers. This word in Greek for soul is psyche. It can be translated life or soul. And there are all different ways and paths that we try to take to save our lives, to save our souls. And we try to, you know, we can do it through our families, our spouses, our jobs. You know, we can accumulate assets, grow our business. You know, we can do it through our toys and hobbies. And when you do that, when you take that path, I think one of two things is going to happen. One, you're going to fail to achieve that, which you set out for, and that can be really discouraging. Or you're going to succeed. Thomas Merton has this quote, which I love. He writes, "We may spend our life climbing the ladder of success, only to find when we get to the top that our ladder is leaning against the wrong wall." I turned 40 this year, which I know for our congregation means I'm on the young side. But one of the benefits of getting a little bit older is that you have had a chance to have some successes and failures, meaning you've sought after something, you've invested a lot of time and energy and resource into that, and you've achieved it. And it could be a job promotion, it could be a success in your business, it could be that motorcycle you dreamed about getting, that trip you always wanted to take, that published book. You know, there's the certain number that you wanted to get into your bank account. And according to Merton, the real tragedy is to spend your whole life thinking at some point, if I can get to the top, that's going to meet the deepest hunger in me. I'm going to finally be satisfied and content, and I'll finally have made it. And then to get to the top of that ladder, you know, after great cost and sacrifice, and realize, oh, crap. I leaned my ladder against the wrong wall. This whole time I was chasing after, I was climbing after on the wrong ladder. I was seeking after the wrong thing, and now it's too late. And Jesus here is, in a sense, taking us up to the top of whatever ladder we're climbing. He's saying, look, even if you get everything you hope for, even if you get to the top, say you gain the whole world. And so whatever the whole world means to you, in the end, you lose. We say yes to Jesus' invitation because we trust that Jesus understands reality better than we do. That in reality, the way to really save your life, the way to really find yourself, as strange as it might sound, is to lose yourself. That might be strange news. It might be counterintuitive news, but it is good news. One final point here about the good news of this this invitation. After Peter confesses Jesus to be the Messiah, Jesus flips everything Peter knows about what it means to be the Messiah on its head. And Jesus presents himself as the suffering Messiah who will be rejected and killed. And then he calls everyone else in and he says, hey, if you want to be my disciple, you're going to have to follow after me. In other words, when Jesus says, follow me, he says, follow me to death. Follow me to what we'll eventually learn is the cross. But that's not the end of the path. I think sometimes in the rigors and the starkness and the difficulty of this call, we can miss this part. Jesus says, after 3 days, he's going to rise. Meaning when you tie your life into Jesus' life, you don't just tie it into his suffering and death. You tie it into his resurrection. What is the worst thing that can happen to you? You die. And as the author of Hebrews writes, all our lives we have been held in slavery by this fear of death. But through the Jesus' death, he breaks the power of the one who holds the power of death, that is the devil. Now, it's no wonder Satan doesn't want Jesus to take the way of the cross, because Satan probably knows that's eventually how he's going to be defeated. Because Jesus has broken the power of death, the worst thing that can happen to you and to me now becomes the best thing. When death loses its power over you, when death loses its sting, nothing has power over you. When the worst thing that can happen to you is the best thing, that's when you're truly free. I mentioned earlier that Dietrich Bonhoeffer famously said, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. On April 9th, 1945, when Bonhoeffer was 39 years old, he was in prison for having spoken out and resisted the Nazi government, and he was hung at the Nazi Flossenbürg concentration camp. And as he approached the gallows, he uttered his final words of defiant and resilient hope. This is the end. For me, the beginning of life. How can he say that? How could someone who's 39 say, for me, the beginning of life, when they're about to be hung? Because he had faith that death was not the end. That when a man or a woman follows Jesus on the way of the cross, the path doesn't end with death. It leads through death to resurrection. Yes, Jesus speaks plainly about the cost of following after him. We can't soften that. We can't temper that. We can't ignore that. But neither can we soften or temper or ignore the incredible good news about following Jesus.